Hello out there in the world of game shows and podcasts. It's me, Cindy Seidelman, with another edition of the Gumbo Cast. On this week's this edition of the Gumbo Cast, we have Mike Richards going to Sony, leaving his post at Price and Deal that he's held for quite a long time, at least 8 years. Common Knowledge in America says getting more and more exposure, and unfortunately, the end of confetti. Along with our regular Just the Stats, Ma'am section, alongside me, Cindy Seidelman, is my partner in crime and the Executive Vice President of Talent Relations for Game Show Gumbo. Among other things, it's Jessica Brand.
Hello, hello. I mean, it's been certainly a curious time because summer always is with this genre. You always have turnover, you have new introductions of what's going on there, what's going off there, of late the summer of games, and of course we have staff turnover. I mean, it's kind of odd. It's been typical and it's atypicalness, honestly.
Absolutely. So what's been going on in your life recently, Jess?
Well, not much. I mean, it's been the same old, in my opinion, from what I've been experiencing right at this very moment. I record this Saturday evening. The game shows, of course, have really started to take on an interesting turn where they're offering bigger prizes, but they're harder to achieve, which for me is a net positive. I know a lot of people don't think that way. You're starting to introduce ultimately a big pay-for-play model and what HQ is trying to do with HQ Words. And that's gotten massive backlash, and they haven't backed down from it. But, I mean, again, there is something to be said about that. See if you can deduct what it is. But I think there's arbitrage there. I mean, you're seeing more of these app shows go off, but it seems like beyond the one we'll cover, confetti, the apps have been fairly constant for a while, and I realize that's a big one. But when you consider the all of the others have been constant, because I'm going to look at what I have on my phone right now. You have Spotus, which is really a search app that's been around for about a year. Reward the Fan, with its infrastructure, has been around for a year. Five Alive is being sold off. SB Live has the backing of Swagbox in that system, so that's going to stick around for a long time. Juryride is considering growing, and I like its innovative model of basically paying its partners to have fans host the shows. That's kind of innovative, and of course, that's starting to finally hit the wires because it is so unique, and I kind of like it. I haven't done it yet, but you gotta give them credit for trying. Then you also have Hoffer, which is a prediction game. HQ, with its giant jackpots for going up to 30 questions over 200,000 if you can nail that, assuming if they pay it. You have the Q, which is, you know, it's very suspect, much the same way. You have Telly, the rebrand of Ripcord, with its great variety of games and probably breaking out into variety games because it knows it can't just survive on trivia. I mean, this is what's happened with confetti.
That's you have true.
Incredible and recognition of basically images in the fastest time. And you have the X, a real-life scavenger hunt with your car for cash. So what we're seeing at this point is composition beyond trivia, but certainly there's an opportunity to pick one of the three answers to get enough right. You can bay old deal or no deal style or play on, or you can just get X number of questions right and you split the pot. I mean, that's not to say the standard formats where if you answer a number right of three choices, you won't get paid. Like, take SB Live on Thursday. That had seven winners on a $1,000 pot, so that's $143 to those who got it.
It's quite amazing, too. And besides, it's not just... I think what... Now, we're talking about that amount of cash in Swagbucks, right? Or is it
in Swagbucks, I mean, you can easily convert that to PayPal without any charge or anything like that. So it may as well be cash.
Right. PayPal, Amazon, stuff like that. Just a nice disclaimer here. I don't play the app games. I don't have anything that I can use to play the app games with. I do have a Note 10.1, but it HQ doesn't work on it. And when Cash Show was a thing, it worked, but I couldn't answer any of the questions. So, yeah, it's this is like an area of game shows that I don't have absolute no knowledge whatsoever. For me personally, I've been busy over this past week. I went to Stomping Grounds, the big WWE pay-per-view that happened this past Sunday.
There you go. I mean, that's kind of why I like playing these, though. Like, these afford you fantastic tickets to whatever you want to go to. So, like, in my case, I love my sports. So, like, I mean, I've made about 10,000 lifetime off of these, basically. I'm very high on the top leaderboards with these because, I mean, I love my quizzing, always have. But, I mean, I'll do my baseball. I'll buy some food. And, I'll try to look at on the side and try to save up some money for some various things. So that's kind of the advantage of doing this, and I get to play with my friends too. I mean, I love that. So,
And in the off out of game show world, this past Thursday, I put on my third annual Gender is a Joke comedy show where I would rate myself and a whole bunch of trans and non-binary comedians would raise money for the Gender Alliance of the South Sound Name Aid Fund. And this year we sold out the Annex Theater in Seattle. Plus, we had a few people standing in the aisles, and we've raised $700 to $800 for the Name Aid Fund. And to be honest, it is something that I'm pretty proud to have done for these past 3 years, and hopefully, God willing, that I will be able to do Gender as a Joke 4, which will take place this time next year, depending if stuff doesn't go awry, so to speak.
well, maybe it'll go pumpernickel for you.
And whether it would be in Washington or another place, who knows? But yeah, that's pretty much been my week. And the funny thing about the wrestling show that I went to, it didn't sell well. It was a 20,000 seat arena. They only sold about like 3,500 seats. A lot of the seats were papered where they gave tickets away, whether flat out giving them away at the Tacoma Mall or there were buy one get one free tickets. So a good chunk of the arena was tarped off, meaning it was just covered in black fabric. And the camera people wouldn't shoot anywhere where there's a whole bunch of black fabric. So yeah, it was kind of weird to see live. I don't know how it turned out on pay-per-view. I haven't watched the pay-per-view yet, mainly because I don't have the WWE network, so I'd have to download a torrent of it or buy the DVD, which I don't think will happen. But it would be interesting to see how it came out live versus over on the WWE network on pay-per-view or something like that. So, Jess, are you ready to go?
Of course.
Right, the big news this past week. Price is Right and Let's Make a Deal executive producer Mike Richards has accepted a deal to go to Sony to be one of their big development people. This will have him oversee new projects, develop new projects, and also revitalize a lot of their old properties. With what he's done on Price and Let's Make a Deal, I think this is a really big coup for Sony, who, while Jeopardy has done well, the rest of their offerings have, well, stagnated over the past few years, we'll say.
Yeah, Wheel has, although it's scored in the ratings. But on that note, in specific note of Wheel and Jeopardy, my guess is that because Harry Friedman is getting up there in age, I think you take the young shot guy like Richards, who's still under 40, and eventually I would have to think he's going to be Friedman's successor. I mean, why not bring in a guy that you can already have under contract at that point, and you have somebody who's very established, with known and existing properties, and turn them into something more modern in the culture relevance part of real society. I mean, it just makes so much sense from an ease perspective. Because that way you don't have to hire him in as CBS would try to lock him in a little bit further. But at this point, he's probably looking for, and obviously it is because he accepted more mobility in his career. And why not take that? I mean, these programs are syndicated. I think they have a little bit better of a broader worldwide reach than Price is Right or Let's Make a Deal do, to be honest. And it just is a logical fit. What's the downside of that? I really don't see any. I think they're going to start them on some of the smaller projects, from what I've understood originally. I think that was in the Variety article that came out about a few weeks ago about this. But I think you could see them on the big products in due time.
Right, I could definitely see Mike Richards doing a lot of work for Game Show Network because right now they are in a massive original burst mode where they're definitely looking to lessen their reliance on Steve Harvey Family Feud. If you remember back to this time last year, like 6 hours of prime time every week, I think, was Harvey Feud. And nowadays, for prime time, it's down to around 3 hours, where you have shows like Common Knowledge, America Says, Cash Cab, and other shows over on overnights, eating away at, their reliance of Feud, and for the better because they've been getting really good ratings. And we'll talk about more about Common Knowledge and America Says later on.
I wonder if the investment relative to views, because Feud still does outdraw those. I mean, not by much, but when you're talking a second-tier cable network like GSN is at this point, I just wonder how much of that they should really do. I love to see innovation, but I mean, from the bottom line of a company or a channel, depending on how you view it, I wonder if it's for the best for them at this moment. As a viewer, obviously, it's great to see some kind of breakup, because that way you can flip and you can see something new that you probably haven't seen before. But it gets more complicated from the perspective of a company, and I'm not sure it's the wisest one. Remains to be seen. I think the fact they're in such expansion mode, like you said, we'll have to see it over a broader sample than what we've been given. And I think that's the critical element that we don't know really either way, and frankly, for that matter, neither would GSM.
Well, it also depends on the ratings that these new shows will get.
Yeah,
Whether
that's what I'm
they're
saying. Kind of a big
comparable,
sample size for him. Yeah.
right, whether they're going to be comparable to Feud's ratings. I don't have the numbers in front of me for Feud, but we know that Common Knowledge and America Says have been averaging high 400s, low 500s for new episodes and reruns. Best Ever Trivia Show, which is on at 4 p.m., has been averaging at the very least 400 to 425 a show.
Yeah,
And
I want
with how
to say,
cheap they are to
yeah, I want to
produce.
say 600s is around what Feud gets.
600.
And basically, the way we have to view this as an equation is that are these shows being 5/6 or 83% the production cost of Feud? And that really is what's going to determine their lifespan. And do they think there's upward growth from that? Because there's the first step, if it's justifying the relative net cost, and then you talk about the projected relative net cost of the programming. And if they don't think there's anywhere to expand on the shows, and let's be honest, most, obviously there are exceptions, but most GSN originals don't wind up growing in programming views. The Chase and Lingo were probably some exceptions, the ones that maybe a person who doesn't watch game shows religiously could name, but that's not the rule. I'm just kind of concerned with what I see in a small sample, and obviously I can be proven wrong because we're dealing with volatile data, and GSM would be the first to tell me that. But I'm just concerned with what I see right now, just when I weigh out everything and when they look at the cost of production.
It also depend not only on cost, but I'll say this: a friend of our site's, I believe this was Tim Connolly or Chico Alexander from Game Show Newsnet. Tim Connolly with Home Game Entertainment said that with these ratings, they're there, but these are all shows that you don't need to pay a lot of close attention to in order to get or to follow along with. And I think it's the best for GSN nowadays to look for those type of shows.
Well, it's best for anything. I mean, the average consumer has an increasingly shortened attention span. If they don't understand how they can play it in a minute, if that, I mean, that's really high, a minute in television to understand something, then they're going to switch the channel. I mean, I think it's 14 seconds on average you have to get a consumer understanding what your product is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's down from about, what, 30, 35 seconds usually. It's the soundbite culture. I've said this multiple times. It's the soundbite culture that we live in.
And frankly, that makes sense. I mean, we have technology that reflects that as a decent parallel. We used to wait forever to, let's say, go on the internet and get our dial-up connections going in the 90s. Now we have these smartphones that give everything literally in a click. Why shouldn't our television shows follow suit? I mean,
exactly.
Why not?
And it kind of has to be that like that, unless you're like a legacy show. A show that is already known to not the mass populace, but a good chunk of it. Like shows like Wheel, Jeopardy, Feud, Pressure Lock, Pyramid, Card Sharks. And unless you're going for full entertainment value, like a Holy Moly, you have to start off hot and start off fast. I think the shows back in the day that would fit nowadays, remember Quicksilver on USA back in the day?
That's a little bit before I started getting into things. I was born in 92, so.
Okay, well, a show like that, where it's just quick fire, ready to go, that is a type of show that I can see being on Game Show Network immediately, because it doesn't take that long to explain, and you could tune in and just ignore it. Ignore it and just keep it on, and you'll be fine.
I mean, as long as you've got, like, if you splice it into, like, the equivalent of a pie for a show, and you can pick any one segment to understand the concept, it probably would fly these days. And then that's not an indictment on the public. It's a proper response. But that usually is probably something similar to, as long as it's engaging, too, it has to be that. Like, you can't put people to sleep. But as long as you've got that as a baseline, you should be good with the primary step of attracting an audience.
Absolutely. Now, another question that we need to ask about Richards moving to Sony is, who's going to take over Price and Let's Make a Deal? Now, I have three names here that could take over one or both immediately and plug in, be good to go. Gabby Johnston, who I believe is now the executive producer of Feud. And her, I think they're taping right now. I think Feud's taping right now. And by the time that Feud is done taping, which will be around early August, she could easily fit into the taping of Let's Make a Deal and Price is Right.
Maybe. I mean, you know, Rich Brian DePiro, who has done so many shows, Millionaire, Pressure Luck, Mental Samurai, basically everything you name it, he's done it at this point. Certainly fits in that mold in terms of directors.
Right. Might be a good director, but we're talking, you know, EP.
Yeah, we're talking
here.
EP. I guess what I'm saying is we have the parallel baseline that people can do multiple shows within a given calendar year because of the flexibility of scheduling of the shows varies. Mm-hmm. So.
And now another name I have is Jennifer Mullen, who has just wrapped doing Card Sharks, Pressure Luck, and I think she does Match Game, even though that's East Coast.
Well, she's on everything because I believe she's situated in Europe. I don't think that one would happen. She's just a big name for Fremantle everywhere. And that's not to take anything away from her, but anything, it's to her power, honestly. But I don't think they're going to associate someone who's more of a name and a global figurehead to be specific on a show. I think he's above that pay grade, actually.
All right. And then the name that I think will probably take over Price immediately is Mike Richards' co-EP, and that is Evelyn Warfel.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes the most sense. I think they probably would go internal at this point. There's really not, I mean, an equivalent to Mike where, ooh, we can snatch up this hot guy from Sony. Let's put him on. But yeah, that probably would make the most sense. I don't really have any internal leads from what I've been told, but going upon what I know, I tend to agree with you that she's probably the lead.
Evelyn Warfel for Price. That the question remains, who do we get for Deal? Is it going to be somebody from Inside, or do they get somebody who was with the show prior to come back and be EP? Because I know Scott Stone was the EP for the first few seasons before Mike Richards took it over. Do you think Scott Stone comes back, or do they give it to somebody like Wayne Brady?
I don't think they'll give it to a host. I mean, not these days. I think they'll just give it to someone internal again. They'll probably just have promotions and so forth. Because when you're talking about a position like this, and you're talking about the very niche and very specific work of game shows, it probably is easiest to just move someone up in the line who's observed, even if they've not done the work necessary to do on a day-to-day or show-to-show, depending on how we view it, basis.
Which is true. So we have Price figured out pretty much. Now it's just a matter of figuring out Deal, and we'll just have to wait and see what Fremantle comes up with.
Yeah, definitely. And unfortunately, I have no leads at this time, but at this point, probably Price and Deal don't either. So they might have some lists, but they probably don't have a favorite. They might have a preferred hire, but again, you never know.
Right.
Or at least not yet.
Next up on our agenda, hits more to home for you than it does for me. I'll just set it up and then you could go to town on it. Facebook's Confetti app, which has, from what I've gathered, been one of the more consistent apps and has had a lot of fun with what they've done, unfortunately decided to end its run Friday on June 28th.
In the States, because Vietnam has 100,000 playing, and then, of course, Mexico has about 1 million people playing twice a day. Sponsored by Business Insider, it started mid-late July last year, and routinely, I think you'd have the best-written questions. You would not have it be on a green screen, but a live stage. You'd have some skits. You'd occasionally have some performers and DJs way back in the early days. But the pay was almost always consistent, and they actually paid the money. Not every app will do that because they're not consistent. But I won, of 249 games they did, I won 75 of them. And that's a little bit artificially low because I had some issues with them around the fourth quarter last year with basically seeing questions. And thankfully they fixed that. But I won about, including the money I won for my family and friends, I'd say about I won $6,000 doing that. And wow. I won about 30% of, no, a little more than 30% of the games. And they ask always very hard questions, too, because you're not going to get big payouts without tough questions. They would ask like 3 or 4 part questions, 10 seconds to answer it. And it was great, too, because you could see what your friends were answering almost always in real time. So you could trust them, you could not trust them, which is always an interesting strategy, hank against them. Or you could split, obviously. So, like, if your friend said this, you might go something else and you don't know because you want to see one of you get it right. The problem is with them in the U.S. is that Facebook probably didn't see it as important. And then they never reached above 30,000. The reason behind that, I think, and its postulation, is pretty simple. The countries that I mentioned, Mexico and Vietnam, were countries that did not have HQ Trivia as a predecessor. and Confetti by Business Insider. I'm not sure if it was by Business Insider and the other ones, but the Confetti brand was the first trivia app that these countries had ever experienced. And you talk about how big HQ was in its heyday, certainly it kind of matched that. And so the early bird gets the worm. But if you're being about 9 months late on the craze, and let's be honest, it's an app craze, then you're probably too late to join the party, which is great for, you know, people like me who love the trivia, and I'm going to play it no matter the outlet. But it's not good for the brand's success as the whole. They had routinely crazy prizes, though. I'd say the median prize was maybe $50. The lowest, it never paid below $1, which is impressive, but it never paid below $2. But usually it was over 10. They tried to always make it over 10, up to $5,000 one time on a fast food game for 5 lucky winners. And I'll miss it, honestly. It was a very, very consistent source of income on my end. I used it to play with friends, to make friendships, and really take out probably what was at least 5 figures, if not 6, combined with what I did. I mean, I know I'm going to go to Mexico if I ever win big on an app, because that way I can play confetti there.
I always find that interesting when... because I remember back in the day, I have a few friends that would always do surveys, you know, for Swagbucks and other sites, and you would get these perks and points and stuff like that. This seems like the new version of it for more technically savvy people, you know, who have smartphones and stuff like that.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, Swagbucks obviously still exists. It has its own game, SB Live. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can get rejoins by doing surveys, so it all really nicely ties together. And the companies that succeed these days, you talk about SB Live in particular, I think that comes to mind, is companies that already had an existing infrastructure. Like, SB Live only gives away $4,500 a week, or 450,000 Swagbucks equivalent a week. Yeah, 450,000 Swagbucks a week. And they probably make it back because they're smart with how they ask if you ever miss a question. If you ever miss, you can always join back. But it will cost you SB, which is indirect gambling, and I'm fine with that. Trust me. I spent one time $50 to rejoin on their game, and I won 333 because I was one of 3 people to win a Disney History Legacy game. That was nice. But what they do to determine what your how many swag bucks you have to buy back in, it's the pot of the game, which is usually 1,000, divided by the number of people to get the question correct, divided by 2. And you can always get it right from that every single time. So I reverse engineered it because I was curious. But that means sometimes you can pay, if it's really that tough of a game, you can pay more than you'll win. That has happened once. But the model is smart because the company's ultimately making money off that. I don't know if they're making a profit. I've been meaning to calculate a random game to see if they actually earn the money back. But therein lies the problem. If you don't have an infrastructure where the users give back, or you don't have something part of a larger concept, if you have a brand in isolation, and I think this was to an extent a huge problem, they have a lot of other ones, but the fact there was no reason to give back, they took a little bit too long on advertising too, because Confetti didn't advertise either. But there's no way to really reach out, advertise your game, and you can have all the thousands of people liking it. You could have about 500,000 people liking the Confetti page, but you're only getting 30,000 of them to play. There's not, we talk about this with YouTube videos actually about search engine optimization. That really wasn't all that great, despite the fact you had Business Insider and Facebook, borderline illegal, but I mean, they had that combination. That could have worked. They really didn't have a retention rate. Yes, you had people like me and my friends who would play literally every night it was possible, but there was no reason for a person to come back. And I mean, eventually, by the time they introduced the VIP High Five, which was you play 5 games, not necessarily in a row, but just play 5 and you get a life, it was too late. And the payouts ultimately suffered a little bit from that. I mean, once again, they struck too late. Confetti was the example of Cinderella Past Midnight. A great time at the party, but ultimately, the cookie had to turn into a pumpkin at some point for them, be it from when they started to really when it ended. And to me, I find that unfortunate. Thankfully, there are so many other games where I continue to make money, but make does not necessarily mean earn. A lot of these apps will advertise these great things, but they will not pay you because they don't think you're legit. Because you know too much. They wouldn't be human to do that. It's kind of astonishing. Confetti was the none, bar none, the best possible for that. They would never take more than like 72 hours to get you all of your money, no matter if it was a few dollars, and it automatically would cash it out for you too, which is amazing. Or if it was a few thousand dollars. I still will never forget the time I won. I was one of 17 people to win my share of $15,000. And then when I won five games of 13 questions in a row, I missed the 13 question games because they reduced it to 10. But I won five 13 question games in a row, 65 questions. And so I put it in the group and I asked for a shout out from the host, Katie Witherspoon, who does a great job with his video game review work. And I wound up getting like a mini shout out saying how I'd won $730 the past week and I'd won all five games. Like, it was incredible. Like, that's the kind of thing that sticks with you. I mean, they tried to do so much with viewer retention and shout outs. Like, you want to talk about flaws of confetti to an extent within the game, from my experience, or people who are really devoted into it, they towards the end would spend at least 10 minutes after the clock struck zero for game starting, devoted strictly to shout outs, and you would have the other 20 minutes devoted to the game itself. I think that's a little bit much, because why are you going to care about really any shout out other than your own? Strictly because that's how ego works in this country. Yours is said, that's great. What's the point now? And that's part of the retention problem. I've noticed that issue with really no other app. Other ones will do shout outs, and I understand that. It's not my favorite part to say the least, but it doesn't drag. And Telly, formerly Ripcord, I think gets that correct. They'll do it like after a third of the game and two thirds of the game. So that way you know you can pace yourself and things start quickly.
Yeah, and is Ripcord still around, or have they got
Ripcord has changed
rebranded?
its name to Telly, because
Okay.
I think they're switching eventually to more variety shows, which is certainly an unprecedented move, although I do like it, so.
All right. So we'll look out for that. Sorry to hear about Confetti ending. I always heard great things about Confetti. Who
Oh,
knows?
yeah.
Maybe it'll come back.
I mean, from what I understand, it definitely will not be. I wish. I wish I could say it was the case. Like, there's reason to think the Confetti brand can succeed, but it won't be here. And there really, I don't think there was anything they could do about that. And it's a shame, really, because they are the best with support. Because I had a question about cashing money out. Because the first time I won them, the first game I played 12,500, they had no winners because the questions were very tough initially. And then 47,500, winners got $585 each. I won on my phone, my mother's phone, and a sister's phone. I just cashed the hell out that night, I tell you what.
Wow.
Yeah, that was sick. And I mean, at one point, it made more money per week than my job. I made more money, and then just that app too. That's not even considering any other app because I play all the apps and I pretty much crush them every time. Because Jeopardy's my favorite show, so that's on right now. So I'd like to think I know a bit about trivia. So
Well, there you go. We'll have more app news in the coming shows, which is Jess's department. And I'm sure she'll have a lot more when it comes more app news in future shows.
oh yeah, definitely. Like if I get a big win or something, you'll be the first to hear about it, and you'll probably get an exclusive for me, at least initially. Because
Yeah.
I like to be vocal. I've always loved the big stage.
Absolutely. Speaking of GSN, we talked about this earlier, and we have some Common Knowledge and America Says news. These are their two biggest originals right now that have
It's
been
more your department. That
yeah
should be.
They have been averaging, at the very least, 450 to 550 for new shows. And they have just wrapped Common Knowledge for 130 episodes, according to a mutual friend of ours, Kimberly Dana, who was an associate producer for that. Sorry. Sorry about that. Lost my place. 130 episodes for Common Knowledge. This is according to our friend Kimberly Dana Baum, who is an associate producer of the show alongside Travis Griffin. And we don't know how many episodes America Says have taped, but it's likely to assume another batch of 130. And both of these start July 13th. Wait, July 13th? No, not July 13th. July 15th. I'm sorry, July 15th is when they start their new seasons. The second season for Common Knowledge and the third season for America Says. What do you think of those numbers, even though we talked about it earlier, we can get more in depth, for those numbers for GSN? Averages.
I think they're a little bit, not much, because you have GSN entering a little bit more of homes, too. But it's not much more than they usually get. That's why I had prior trepidation and prior concern about what's going on with these right now. Do they have room to grow? Of course they do. We've seen shows take off later than this and do better. And I like the programming, too, from my individual standpoint. But it's not really where I think they want it relative to the cost of what they have from... I mean, Harvey Feud is really the baseline because that's where you can run for that cost, and that is probably their best overall investment. Like, if you take each show... each individual program, I guess you should say.
Mm-hmm.
Family Feud is one. These are all one show. Family Feud has the best return on your investment, your ROI. You don't like stocks. These other ones are new and up-and-coming IPOs that have the potential to take the old stalwart, but it doesn't look like they will right now. And that's kind of a shame, because I think these are just going to go eventually through the motions, and they're going to be fun to watch. But they're not going to justify any kind of long-term renewal, and we'll just see the cycle start all over again, with new ones eventually coming to replace these. I don't think there's any reason to think they're going to change how they view programming because of these. And again, that's really a shame, but sometimes that's the cost of business.
It's kind of interesting how they did it, is because these all started as daytime programs where Feud wasn't airing, like around 4 o'clock, because 4 or 5 o'clock, because Feud was not airing at these time slots. These were shows like Chain Reaction, Wheel of Fortune, Deal or No Deal. That's what was airing around these time slots, and they got great enough ratings at those time slots to say, why don't we try these out at 7 o'clock or 9 o'clock, and they've either had the same amount of ratings or have gotten higher ratings because of that time slot, and because of the Family Feud lead it, where they didn't lose a lot of the Feud lead in, or in some cases gained off of Feud.
Ugh. I just wonder about some of the time slots they put these up against. I know you can't really control a syndicated show too much like Feud is, but like if you're going against that, it's just going to wind up hurting the show. I would try to ask my affiliates that air the show to not run it in specific slots, but it's just a mess.
But then again, you also have to take consideration we now have DVR, and DVRs are now... DVR ratings are counted via the Nielsens.
Yeah, thankfully.
It's still on paper. It means that people are still watching.
Yeah, that's incorrigible, at least. I just think we gotta have more on-demand stuff. I think GSN is a good test channel for something like that, that really doesn't have all that steady, relatively speaking, to other networks of programming blocks. Like, why not? Like, pick a button here. Here's the shows we're going to have on offer these days. You can click one of these and you can watch it. Like, just have the day's programming available to watch and see if you can't get counted that way. I know it would take a lot of work with Nielsen and how they count the ratings, but I feel like that's the future, where you basically order off of a menu of television, which is kind of like Netflix, but not entirely. You have the available programming for the day, but that's what you're limited to.
I was
And you can watch
thinking
it
this
whenever.
is right. I was thinking this is more akin to the old on-demand shows.
Yeah, it's kind of like on demand. But this is so specific in what you can order, because you can't order off the menu. Don't know. Worth a shot, I think.
And speaking of America Says, they are taking the 135 episodes that they have already taped and have aired on GSN, and they are going into syndication starting in September. This will be the second new show for syndication, quote unquote. They'll be joining 25 Words or Less.
Yeah, 25. I'm curious about what they do with 25 words or less, because I had a friend who, Robert, who's been on this before discussing things, who got basically all the episodes early because he was in a test market. Are they just going to wind up airing the shows that they already aired essentially on a national level? I imagine they would. It makes sense, but that's a fun format if you haven't seen it, and it bears just enough of a challenge, and it's got that great password and pyramid feel where you can just play along at home. And really, the nice thing too, and I don't think enough shows offer this, they offer the contestants an opportunity to choose really what your difficulty is going to be. And there's not enough of that just in general. I mean, Jeopardy has it, certainly, and we kind of forget Jeopardy offers that, at least theoretically, because sometimes Jeopardy is inconsistent. 25 Words is very consistent about what they are, because I remember they did, I think they did Doppelganger or something like, yeah, Doppelganger, I think, was one of their red hard words, which I guess you could say look-alike, maybe, but
And I think with America Says going into syndication, this is good news for GSM because they'll be able to advertise during the commercial breaks.
I think that's a big benefit, yeah.
And if it goes well with, and this isn't the first time that a GSN show entered syndication. Baggage did it before.
That's right.
And this
Forgot about
was during a time period where GSN wasn't in as many homes. Or didn't get as much rating as the ratings that it does now. 7 years prior than they do now.
Maybe that bears greater success, or perhaps it doesn't, or maybe it washes. You have greater homes with availability, but are as many people just going to watch their television like it's 1990? I just wonder about that.
Well, it would have to be a different year than 1990.
Yeah. But I mean, you know what I mean, like, we're just going to watch our TV because that's what we've got. Yeah.
Well, you also have a lot of cord cutters out there who have antennas because antenna TV is coming back.
Yep.
And I could see a lot of viewers who will see these shows and be like, maybe I want more. Oh, GSN's got it. And GS at this time, GSN will be airing new to them episodes. Because I'm assuming the batch of episodes for America Says are going to air first on GSN and then possibly air in syndication if they get a renewal. Which is an interesting strategy that Sony is doing. New shows for GSN, and if they succeed in that smaller market, maybe they'll work at a larger scale in syndication.
I mean, I think it's worth a shot, and it's certainly, I think it's certainly an upward potential move for them. So I wish them well with it.
Anything else you want to, any other thoughts that you have on Common Knowledge or America Says, or maybe even a Best Ever Trivia Show, because they've been getting 400 to 425 at 4 o'clock.
Yeah, Best Ever Trivia Show is, I think, very surprising for what KSN has been offering in terms of its programming, in terms of what we've come to expect. I personally think it's a really good offering. I hope it continues to do well. I really do. A returning champion show, like, that feels very uncommon in 2019, and you get a chance to possibly be one of the essentially the eggheads.
Yeah.
Like, what a great idea. I wish it, the same way I feel about Chase, I wish it really had a network that would give it more visibility, but I'll take it when I could get it, so.
I think when it comes back to the Chase, I think they had the visibility. The problem is, at the end of that fourth season, there was some turnover that was happening, and they didn't want to push this behemoth show, even though you could put it on anywhere and it would double or sometimes triple the ratings that it would be put on early from a year ago.
Yeah. That's why I wish, like, the Fox pilot with, like, say, Bradley. And nothing. I mean, that's why I wish the Bradley Walsh with Fox one had been picked up. I mean, independent of Post, but, like, I mean, you know, just get a network out there that can shine this, marketed, and really is more accessible to the common viewer, or yeah, more likely to hit, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, fingers crossed for America Says It's Syndication. Also, fingers crossed for Common Knowledge on GSN for Season 2. Hopefully it'll do just as well, if not better, in Season 2 than it did for Season 1. 500... averaging at least a 500,000 viewers every episode. Wow.
Yeah.
The raw sexual power of Joey Fatone.
Can't spell Fatone without fat one.
Mmm. Anyways, let's put the sexual tension aside and have just the stats, ma'am. This is a brand new segment here for the Gumbo Cast, where Jessica Brand and myself will be talking about various trivia minutiae when it comes to numbers, facts, figures, anything that we can break down and do well with in regards of win-loss and how to figure out games for Price is Right or all around the game show world. We wanted to start off this one with something that has been sticking in our craws for the past few weeks. Ever since the loss of James Holzhauer's run on Jeopardy, let's talk about final Jeopardy wagering. Especially, and we're going to use James Holzhauer's loss as the prime example as to he did the absolute right thing strategy-wise.
Yes.
And just break it down.
So few players wager correctly. We didn't see it in the teen tournament correctly. We almost never see it correctly. But James was exactly correct in how to do this. The scores going into Final Jeopardy are Emmett at 26,600, James at 23,400, and Jay at 11,000 even. So James's best wager is 1399, which is what he did. So Why that's important is because that's as much as he can put up against Emma without being taken over by a double on the part of Jay. So, James, in this sense, is protecting against the fact that if Emma misses, and if he misses, but Jay somehow gets it correct, he wins. Because Jay can only go to 22,000, he's one of going to the wager that puts him at 22,001. And because Emma is probably going to try to go 20,201 to cover James, if she misses, she's out. If James even hits, then he can't win because, you know, the most he's going to get is 22,000. So he's counting on Emma on a subject that she's very familiar with because she did a lot on Shakespeare historically.
Yep.
But all that has to happen is that she misses. It doesn't matter what James does in this instance because of the size of the wager and what it is relatively to James, Jay. Jay is out at this point regardless with the wager of $13.99. That's incredible. to see that. Like, I mean, I know there are some stories out of Holzhauer that I had heard that he spent anywhere from 30 to 40 hours alone on ringing in on a signaling device, which, again, that's not really practiced a whole lot by people. I'm talking about strategies that were appropriate. And yes, of course, he did essentially shout-outs with his wagering, but they were also very sound wagering to try to do what his score was relative to the opponent's score. I draw a parallel to Wheel of Fortune when you're picking bonus round letters. You have all the time in the world when you can do that. You can spend all the time you want when you're deciding your Jeopardy wager, too. And if you want to calculate the expected weighted value of those clues that are remaining, that's not terribly hard to do. But James was able to do it pretty easily, exactly what should be done. I'm amazed more people don't study this. It's information that is easily and readily available on Andy Saunders' J-Archive. Absolutely incredible work, what he and Robert do on there. But that's the right thing to do. You want to wager a little, because if you go above that, then you could tie Jay. There's no guarantee you beat him on the buzzer in a tiebreaker. And because you're not going to catch Emma, you're stuck in the middle. So you count on one player missing, which is probably your best odds, rather than two missing. So why not? There's no downside to that.
I think it's something that people have forgotten. Or maybe they don't remember or don't recall that when it comes to regular games now, there are tiebreakers. Because before the regular season adopted tiebreakers, I believe in 2016? The 2016 season with the first tiebreaker?
Yeah, he would have wagered 1,400 if they didn't exist, because there's no disincentive to him having a player back at that point. Because it doesn't matter who James plays theoretically in the next game, he can just play his own game and not worry about that. But given only one player from each show at most, because, you know, 0-0-0 happened twice, can happen, he's going to put himself at the most advantageous position to do so.
Right. It's also happened in tournaments.
Yeah, definitely. We had a tiebreak clue this past week, so. Which should never be happening. There's no reason, realistically, short of Final Jeopardy scores being tied, that you should be doing that. I mean, really? Why? I mean, honestly, honestly, at that point, players should be adjusting to what their category strengths are. It's kind of prisoner's dilemma at that point. I understand that. But if your scores aren't tied, why are you playing for the tie? Why? Would you're $1 less or more and trust yourself? Or don't, if you think it's something your opponent is terrible at. But consider strategy beyond tying. I don't understand this. Why this is happening still. Tiebreakers are fun to watch, but they're not fun to watch from executing proper strategy. If you're going to get on Jeopardy, as I want to do, study your strategy. Know Betteridge's Law, like second player betting big sometimes. Know multiple choice. Know all the terms that are in the J-Archive that can make you such a better player, and considering all the situations that you might find yourself in. Good wagering makes close games winnable for players that otherwise wouldn't win more often than they should. Mm-hmm. Because people don't know how to do it. It's remarkable. For a show that bills itself as the smart show, and I would argue right now it is, even though I find it's decreasingly so in its difficulty, the people that can memorize enough stuff don't take the time to memorize a few more facts that can make the difference in what we're scoring here. I guess that's confounding to me. And the fact that people aren't being aggressive enough on daily doubles. James has introduced that concept into game theory, and James has also introduced the concept that the lights may affect you, or maybe they won't. That's not to say discount the lights, but it's not to say that the lights are guaranteed to be a factor, because he treated the money as not assured before it was won, and I actually employed a similar strategy in one of my own games elsewhere in the world. But that's how I view it, because you have to be willing to take that risk for what the reward is, relatively. And people still don't do it. It's almost as if this run didn't exist in that specific respect. I don't get it. Like, I mean, I understand not everyone's going to know the strategies, but if you're going to be on the show, you're someone who is obviously almost always qualified to be on the show. Learn a little bit of math. It won't hurt you. There's a free calculator that lets you literally put things in and determine what you should do. Why not use it? I mean, if we're going to learn the quadratic formula, which I think is more complicated than Jeopardy, in your little high school math class, you can learn proper wagering. Come on, people.
Or logarithms, for that matter.
Yeah.
I
I mean,
would.
I did hedge funding. That's a lot more complicated than this. I mean,
Right.
Black-Scholes option pricing model. Look that up, kids. Yeah.
I will say this in regards to the Wednesday game, the Wednesday semifinals, because we use that clip for Game Show Gumbo. From my perspective, the two teams who played to that tie, well, it was. You had a third place contestant who was so far back, where his only hope is both the tied players bet it all and lose. But that didn't happen. But there's another aspect that I want to bring into this, and that's tournament wagering for final. Because you're playing with a different set of rules than you are to a regular game in Jeopardy. Because not
You are.
only because you have the five winners, but you also have the four wild card spots. And
Yeah.
going back through, I was looking at the J Archive for because a friend of mine had a contestant who won a college championship years ago. So I was looking at the wagering of finals and who qualified where. And it seemed like if you have a score at 20,000 nowadays, 20,000 is usually the baseline that is good enough to get you in the semis.
Interesting.
So
Yeah. I mean, I
you.
guess that makes sense, too.
Right, because remember, you have the four wild card spots
You're right. I
for
was thinking
the.
about those too as I was saying that because I went to Airborne. I was running some numbers in my head as you're saying that, but the average show on Jeopardy, because they were bringing this up during James's run actually, what the average show pays, including the two players who don't win. The average show pays about, I think it was 17 or 18,000. So if we subtract 3,000 from that, we're going to get about 14,000 as a baseline. But you always want to go a little more aggressive than that because of the nature of the tournament, and some people might think that. So if you're going to stay a little step ahead, you're probably going to go with 19 or 20. I think probably the baseline figure for what you're talking about is, if you really want to get what the break-even point is expected to be, at least, it's probably a little bit lower than what you're saying. But I think it's a good enough cold and hard fast rule to use as what you should aim for. I like it.
At least get to 20 for the total for the day, where if you don't win, you're pretty much guaranteed a spot in the wild card. You could take a look at the figures from last year's Tournament of Champions, where you want to know what the average non-winning score was that got you
Cool.
into the wild card, that got you the wild card spot.
Sure.
It was between 16 and 17,000.
Okay. So what that tells me about behavior, from contestants, or at least ones who are in the tournaments, if that's the average, then people are catching on to the fact that you need to wager a little bit more because, you're going to have to win a little more than an average show. And of course, you're dealing with players who are better than the average player in that respect. However, I think you should be a little bit more aggressive than that because I maintain that you should play very aggressively on trivia games and apps and all of this bullshit. But if you're doing that, you're guaranteeing yourself. Like, I lean towards Marcian wagering rather than Venetian if you really want to go into the Jeopardy terms of it. But if you're being more aggressive, yeah, it has more downside. But, I mean, if you didn't get it anyway, you probably weren't going to get a spot regardless. So, given tournament play, how you need to advance with wagering, you need to bear more and be more aggressive than what your opponents are expecting. Because we're talking about an average, and I'm curious where our bell curve is a center point and what the standard deviations are. Because I'm wondering if 3,000 is like basically SD1. I would try to go with whatever SD2 is. So if your base is 68.8 and SD1, shoot, well, SD2 is 99.44. I remember SD3 is 99.6. SD1 is 86.4, I think it is. I'm going to verify that. It's standard deviation. I should know these off the top of my head. Okay, so yeah, okay, it's 34.1, 34.1, 13.6, 2.1, okay. Actually, so I overestimated the... Oh, wait, no, I didn't. It's okay, so 13.6 and 68.2. 68.2 and 13.6 would be your answer there. So 68 and 13 is 31, and then, yeah, 81.7. So what I want to do there is I want to give 81.7... And then I want to do, okay, so I want to do 31.7 more the average play. So I want to do 31.7 times 14,000, which I believe is the average. So it's 14,300, I think, if I want to be precise here. So 14,300 times 1.31 is 18,733. That's the target score I want to play for. And as you mentioned, the target score of these average folks is somewhere between SD0 right hand side to SD1. So if we're going on the full standard deviation above, we've insured about a 25% chance better winning just by adding a few thousand more to our wagers. And that's overall. That's not even in Final Jeopardy. That's about considering any daily doubles we have. If we consider there are four wagers and an average player gets 1.33 of them, the difference between that is going to be, if you give me a second here, all right, so we're going to do that minus 14,000. And we're considering 1.33 divided the players. So we're talking about adding $3,559 to an average expected wager, be that in and that's in total of expected clues. So, I mean, we eventually want our wagers to be $3,559 divided by whatever number of daily doubles plus Final Jeopardies we get. And we know it's at least one. Actually, that should be divided by 1.3/4. But the point stands. We're going to wager about 1,000 more if we get every single wager, and then we adjust accordingly to that. So 3,600 is our baseline to what we're going to add to, essentially, if we're talking about increasing our wagers to essentially be a step ahead of the opposition, but not going too far because we don't want to wind up risking ourselves if it's a category we don't really know. But that little bit more of aggression hasn't been touched upon by Jeopardy players en masse yet. Yeah. That's an opportunity that I would look for. I wouldn't expect to see, but it would be interesting to see if someone executed it. James is not on that end. James is on those little bitty tails that you're going to expect to see on maybe on Haley's comment on that 0.1, on that 3 Sigma Sanctuary, that 0.1%.
Well, you may be seeing a lot more active wagering when we get to the new season that's coming out in September, because the season had already wrapped by the end of the teen tournament.
Yeah, well, what I'm curious about is we're at the point where people are going to start to see the first few days of James's run. So, I mean, we're going to find out sooner than later if there's anything to this. I'm talking specifically tournament play here, and I believe tournament play reflections of wagers are more apt to being appropriate on the more conservative side, actually, in terms of winning in regular gameplay. So let's say we have base wager. Base wager is number one. And we have base wager 1.5. That is the aggression that's required to win an average game, assuming a normal distribution of daily double finding. In tournament play, 1.5 is the default. So we need to ultimately go to number two in terms of standard deviations of expected wagers. So basically, players are, what a shock, they're not being aggressive enough. The math even supports that as a fact because of the number you gave of expected wild cards.
That's right, of 20,000.
Yeah. 20, actually, no, that might be a little bit high. No, that's right, that's actually a little bit high. But it's not by much. We know it's like 18,886 from what I was saying. So to be 1,400 off, divided by the expected 1.33 is going to be... It's like, here, folks, I have to calculate this really fast. It doesn't take long, but it does take not immediate time. So about 1,000 more. So we're talking about 1,000 more on an expected wager opportunity, which, again, is a daily double in either round or a Final Jeopardy. That's how close this number was. $1,053 off that she gave.
Wow.
It's close.
Right, and I was just, you know, just doing an eyeball test and saying, okay, if you add up the total amount that's on the board without using daily doubles yet, it's 45,000, 15,000 in regular Jeopardy, 30,000 in Final Jeopardy.
Yeah,
45,000, so if you get more than a third of that, just on base, which would be about 20,000, because we're also dealing with teenagers who, just speaking for first round tournament play, your main goal is to at least get to the semis. So I think you and I can agree that when it comes to daily double wagering, it's okay to play a little bit safe, because that's because you'll want to do the big bet for final. If you're around 15,000, 16,000, you do half wager to at least get you to 24.
I think it depends relatively to where you are to scores too. I mean, ultimately, in the average game, because remember, the numbers I'm saying here are for strictly an average game, because we're talking about what we would expect to see of typical behavior of a contestant.
Right.
But we have to adjust for that depending on the game necessarily, and that's something James did very well, because, I mean, as much as he was dominating, that actually made it a little bit easier, more realistically.
Yeah.
Because there was really not much as much math to calculate, okay, what's the most they're going to get from the remaining clues relative to me minus my difference. That's what he did, essentially, in his head. Which sounds impressive, and I guess it is, but it's not really that difficult.
But sadly for him, it didn't work for the World Series of Poker.
Yeah. I mean, that's just the thing, though. I mean, there are obviously some examples, because we're talking standard deviations and their sigmas, about, 13.6 off, that would be, so around, we would expect in a normal distribution, this strategy did not work about 17% of the time, but of an average player, and we can adjust for that. We're talking about, again, a baseline that we can adjust accordingly, and given how the teen tournament, let's be honest, I love the Jeopardy Clue Writers, they work hard, they do a great job, these lean very easy, and not talking about my experience here, but how the teens did, when you're talking about games that are buzzer races and daily doubles are limited in scarcity, essentially, then you need to wager more. And that reflects that. Because think about what James did. If you're a great player relative to the board that you see, so let's take James as an example here, because he routinely did this. You're going to wager more on the daily doubles because you have greater confidence in your ability to get them right.
Right. And you're also got to remember how James Holzhauer did the board. Normal players would go bottom to top to bottom, or if you're playing the Chuck Forrest strategy, which we saw a little bit more after Arthur Chu became champion, he just bounced around the lower half of the board trying to find the daily double, get it out of play.
Yeah, the brand mark has always been a very mix of those two strategies, even before James made them popular, but after Arthur Chu did. So the brand mark is you start at the heat map. The heat map refers to where you're most likely to find the daily doubles, because daily doubles are the scarcest quantities of anything on the board, because they allow you to put in what your wager is. So historically, and James recognized this as well, and he didn't do this truly to the brand mark, but he was very similar in some respects. So the daily doubles historically are going to be 1,200 or 16 clues, rather than 2,000, historically. They can obviously be in the 2,000 as much as they can be in the 400. I'm much more likely about 5 to 1 to be in the 2,000 to 400. But we're going to start mid in double Jeopardy. In single Jeopardy, we do start bottom up, because James correctly, astutely noted that they're most likely to be in the $1,000 spot. So yeah. What we do is we start at 16, 16, 16, 16, 16, 12, 12, 12, and then we bounce it around, kind of like it's a whirling snake, essentially, around the board. It's almost a bounce, but I call it more like a snake, because we're staying on a consistent line until we hit that point.
All right. Sounds good to me, and we will talk more about Jeopardy strategy and other strategies and stats.
Watch them on TV.
Yep. And that, ladies and gentlemen, and everything in between, is your stat lecture for this episode of GumboCast. And now, let's get something that is not entire... Well, there's no map required for this one. Except for this one. I have a math problem for you, Jess.
Okay.
Okay. A Tennessee cowboy drives down the lane at about 50 miles per hour in a Ford F-350 Hemi truck. Going left. Going on the right side of the same lane is a SUV that could hold 9 people traveling at 55 miles per hour on a full tank of gas.
Right.
Now, judging by how much alcohol has been consumed, because this was after a Tennessee Titans game where they lost 20-13 against the New England Patriots. And it was buy two get one free beer day at the bar. What do you think about Bob Saget hosting Nashville Squares?
I mean, why not? I personally really liked his work. I realize it's not really a game show, but AFE, he was always a good presenter there. I liked his work on 1 vs. 100. And my hope with Saget is that he gets to be, and I feel like game shows have hampered him, not through his own fault or really anybody's really, but I always like Saget most when he's possible to be free, be himself, and be very expressive and brash. I've always appreciated that about him.
Like, for me, this could be the second best well-known property he could get.
I mean, it's a good one, too, because Hollywood Squares is just such a perfect back-and-forth banter beer with the contestant or the celebrity. Like, what a great fit.
Yep. If I were to give him a show, I would kind of go back to the archives and maybe give him Make Me Laugh.
Yeah.
Because he does have experience with that show. He was on that show. And he did quite well at it. But, in all honesty, I think what kind of is... might get me interested in this is how Saget reacts to the country stars. Now, Saget does do folk style music in his act, but I think this will be interesting to see how he plays off with country stars like Big and Rich or Florida Georgia Line or countrified comedians like Jeff Foxworthy.
That's what makes this unique, though. Like, I mean, you talk about what Hip Hop Squares was, I mean, and is, I guess. But, like, this is certainly a different angle on that, to be sure. I love the ingenuity of it, and I think you could see, maybe not with names necessarily at Saget size, but I think you could see, like, regional variants of game shows, honestly, propping up, because people have the national product, right, that they kind of understand on some level, but you're making it local. You're making something bigger than yourself, but you're reducing it to a local level, which is, I think, you know, it's something that hasn't been tapped enough, just in general as market shares. Like, we have this for sports teams. Like, everyone has different markets, and every team markets their own way for various things. Why not do that for, you know, television? Why not?
It also helps that you're also dealing with a show that doesn't have a live property on right now, because I think Hip Hop Squares has been canceled again.
Yeah. I was excited for that, though. I'm disappointed, but yeah.
I think the problem is that with Hip Hop Squares, when it came back, is they did too much to it.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work. And I will say this, D-Ray Davis sucks as a host. I would have him as a panelist, but I wouldn't have him as a host. I think Dion Cole would have been better fitted as a host. Because he did well with Face Value, which is the same genre of style. But I don't think D-Ray was any good hosting that show, and I honestly did not like the scoring format whatsoever. Because you could win both games and still lose.
Yeah.
So I have to wonder how Nashville Squares will fix that little tweet, fix that little niggle.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I mean, you never know what they could introduce, and I mean that necessarily for the good or the bad, but you never know what these shows are going to introduce when they do their own revivals of things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you told me a Press Your Luck revival was coming back a couple years ago, one, I might have looked like you with three heads, but I would have never guessed the end game that we have with it. Which I really like, but I mean, it's just, you wouldn't associate it with it. Because there are always wild things you can do to these properties.
Exactly. And as for Saget, I think this is good for him because it will wash off the stink of AFV After Dark.
Yeah. I mean, it says something that I have already forgotten about that. That's, yeah.
I never saw it.
Yeah, I never did either. I mean, I know I had planned to, but that's how quickly it went past my radar. Like, in one ear and out the other. Or one in one eye and out the other. Now, that sounds like kind of like I'm gouging six, them.
It was, I think it was like a 6 and out. It was supposed to be like a 13 episode run, but only got 6.
Yeah.
Oh, well. But we wish Saget the best of luck.
Definitely. Because, I mean, the premise is great, so.
And that will wrap it up for this edition of the Gumbo Cast. We talked a lot of great information about game shows. You got a lot of stat information and strat information about Jeopardy. Jessica, what do you have plans for our next show when it comes to just the stats, man?
I guess it depends what's going to come up of things that revolve around strategy. I know there's something I've been noticing that people have not been paying attention to in Press Your Luck, and it's really been bothering me in particular, because actual pays. Jeopardy wagering is the key one. Price is Right is always an interesting one, because I keep my price list database, Wheel of Fortune out of my puzzle database. Price is Right is one I really have not talked about really as much in public about what I can help people with, be it the live show or the show out in Hollywood. So it's probably going to be Price is Right related to really noticing some trends that people have not really caught on yet, really on a large level. So there was that great article that said, how to win every Price is Right game. They didn't touch upon some of the stuff that I know and can basically deal with in the audience and so forth. One thing I will say up front, and I hate to do this, and it's kind of obnoxious, but if you shout over the announcer descriptions, or at least parts that are not important and are kind of fluffy, then you're going to make sure your voice is heard, and it's going to be the first one heard. Because I have done that before, and it works.
Mm-hmm.
Is it obnoxious? Yes. Does it work? Yes. So I think you'd rather see people win things than lose things, but that's me.
Right. And we'll have more game show news, which will pop up in the near future. We will try to get the next show out in a couple of weeks. And if you want this wonderful podcast early, all you got to do is go to our Patreon at www.patreon.com/gameshowgarbage. I'd like to note that that name will be changing come September. Maybe a little bit earlier than that. And even a $1 monthly donation, that gets you early access to the Gumbo Cast. And will get you free perks in our Discord coming in September.
Yeah, that'll get you a free cup of the soup. So why not get your bowl? Get
yes. A scoop.
Let's eat.
Absolutely. Jessica, thanks for joining me. And until next time, we will see you next time here at the Gumbo Cast. Until next time, bye-bye.